luxurious, and even exhilarating, in every way more welcoming than the public arcades and atriums that have preceded it in buildings like Olympic Tower, the Galleria, and Citicorp Center. That review had two positive effects. First, it reinforced the feeling among the retailers in the atrium and the people who'd purchased apartments in Trump Tower that they'd made the best choice. But second, and more important, it helped bring more shoppers to the atrium. They, of course, were ultimately the key to its success. The odd thing is that no one could ever quite believe that the atrium was a commercial success. From the day it opened, false rumors circulated. One was that while it was obviously a tourist attraction, no one really bought anything there. Another was that the European retailers stayed only because their stores functioned as high-visibility loss leaders. Still, other stories had it that the stores on the ground floor did well, but those on the upper floors did not. As late as 1986, a New York Times reporter came to see me, obviously prepared to do a hatchet job on the atrium. Instead, he did his reporting and ended up writing a front-page business section story about the atrium's extraordinary success. Typically, a suburban mall has a turnover of at least a third of its original tenants during the first several years. Trump Tower lost only a handful of its stores during the first 3 years. More important, no sooner does a tenant leave than he is replaced by one of the 50 retailers we have on our waiting list. Stores with the most expensive merchandise in the world have prospered in the atrium. Not every quality retailer has found the location appropriate, of course. The best example is the experience of Lowe, the leather goods retailer, which was among the atrium's first tenants. Lowe had beautiful merchandise, but it turned out that while a wealthy woman might pay thousands of dollars for a piece of jewelry or an evening gown at a shop next door, she was not willing to shell out $3,000 for a pair of Lowe's leather pants, no matter how soft and buttery they might feel. So Lowe's didn't do well. But in the end, everyone came out okay. Asprey, which was doing very well next door, took over Lowe's space. Lowe, therefore, got out of a long-term lease. Asprey got an additional 4,600 square feet it very much wanted, and I got a great new lease. One last element helped make the Trump Tower deal a huge home run, and that was something called a 421A tax exemption. Ironically, getting my 421A ended up taking me longer than it had to assemble the site and complete the entire construction of Trump Tower. The city enacted the 421A law in 1971 to encourage residential development. In return for improving a site, developers were entitled to an exemption from real estate taxes over a 10-year period. Every 2 years, the exemption decreased by 20%. Everyone who applied for the 421A exemption got it, almost as a matter of course. Then I came along with Trump Tower. There was no question that I was entitled. I was proposing to take a 10-story building in a state of disrepair and to build in its place a multi-use 68-story $200 million tower. Unlike the tax abatement I'd gotten on the Grand Hyatt, where I was forgiven all taxes, the 421A program wouldn't exempt me from taxes currently being paid on the site, but it would exempt me from additional taxes attributable to an increased assessed value on the site. Who could argue that I wouldn't be improving and better utilizing the site with Trump Tower? Ed Koch could, for one. And the reason had nothing to do with the merits of my case. It was all politics. Koch and his deputies sensed an opportunity they couldn't resist. To position themselves as consumer advocates taking on a greedy developer. From a public relations perspective, I was vulnerable. It was quite obvious that Fifth Avenue wasn't exactly a marginal neighborhood, and that I'd probably succeed with Trump Tower even if I didn't get a tax exemption. But in my mind, none of that had any bearing on my legal right to a 421A exemption. In December 1980, I applied for a 421A for the first time. A month later, I met with Tony Glidman, Commissioner of the City's Department of Housing, Preservation, and Development, to make my case in person. In March, Gleidman and the HPD turned my application down. I called Koch and told him I thought the ruling was unfair, that I wasn't about to give up, and that the city was going to waste a huge amount of money litigating a case I'd eventually win. In April 1981, I filed something called an Article 78 proceeding in state Supreme Court, seeking to have the city's ruling overturned. The court found in my favor, but an appellate court reversed the ruling. So I took my case to the state's highest court, the Court of Appeals. In December 1982, nearly 2 years after my original application, the Court of Appeals ruled 7-0 that the city had improperly refused me an exemption. But instead of simply ordering the city to expedite my exemption, the court told the city to reconsider my request. They did, and turned me down again. By now I was so outraged that the cost of the litigation was beside the point. We refiled in Article 78, and exactly the same scenario unfolded. We won in Supreme Court, got overturned at the appellate level, and ended up again before the Court of Appeals. My lawyer, Roy Cohn, did a brilliant job, arguing before seven justices without so much as a note. This time, the court again ruled unanimously that we were entitled to our exemption, and ordered the city to provide it without further delay. That was just the icing on the cake. By this time, Trump Tower was an unqualified success. It had given me visibility and credibility and prestige. It was also a great success financially. The way I figure it, the entire project, including land, construction costs, architecture fees, advertising and promotion, and finance charges, cost approximately $190 million. The sales of apartments have so far generated $240 million, meaning that even before including revenues from the stores and offices, we have earned a profit of approximately $50 million on Trump Tower. I also earned more than $10 million in commissions as a sales agent for apartments in Trump Tower. Finally, the rent from office space and the retail atrium generates many millions more a year, almost all of it profit. Ultimately, Trump Tower became much more than just another good deal. I work in it, I live in it, and I have a very special feeling about it. And it's because I have such a personal attachment that I ended up buying out my partner, Equitable, in 1986. What happened is that Equitable put a new guy in charge of its New York real estate operation. One day this fellow called me up and said, "Mr. Trump, I've just been looking over the books, and I'd like you to explain why we're spending so much on the maintenance of Trump Tower." We were, in fact, spending nearly $1 million a year, which is almost unheard of. But the explanation was very simple. When you set the highest possible standards, they're expensive to maintain. As one simple example, my policy was to have all of the brass in the atrium polished twice a month. Why, this fellow asked, couldn't we save some money by polishing once every couple of months? At first, I was civil. I tried to explain that one of the key reasons for the success of the atrium is that it was so impeccably well run. I also said I had no intention of changing our policy, and I suggested to this executive that perhaps he ought to take a day to think about whether he really wanted to push it. He called me back 24 hours later, and he said he'd thought about it, and he did want to go ahead with cutbacks. That was probably the end of my partnership with Equitable. Much as I liked Equitable, I wasn't about to tamper with something so successful just to save a few bucks. To do that would have been totally self-destructive. I was upset, but I was also philosophical. I went to my friend George Peacock, the head of real estate at Equitable, and I explained that we had a problem, and that there didn't seem to be a way out of it. Therefore, I wanted to buy out Equitable's share. In a short time, we made a deal, and I now own Trump Tower outright. After we'd signed the contracts, I got a letter from George Peacock, who ended by saying, "As with most things in life, time calls for change, and it is best to accept that fact. Nevertheless, I shall always be proud of my involvement in the creation of Trump Tower and fondly remember how we worked to bring it about." I was very happy to get that letter. It was a classy way to conclude a partnership that had been a class act from the start. Chapter 8. Gaming. The Building on the Boardwalk. The first time the economics of the casino gaming business really came home to me was one day late in 1975. I was driving along in my car to yet another meeting about the Commodore Hotel deal when a news report came on the radio. Hotel employees in Las Vegas, Nevada, the announcer reported, had just voted to strike. Among other consequences, the stock price of Hilton Hotels, which owned two casinos in Las Vegas, had dropped tremendously. By this time I knew something about the hotel business, but I was still stunned. How was it possible that the stock of a company that owned at least 100 hotels worldwide could be hurt so badly by a strike against just two of them? When I got back to my office, it took only a small amount of research to find out the answer. Hilton, it turned out, owned more than 150 hotels worldwide. But its two casino hotels in Las Vegas accounted for nearly 40% of the company's net profits. By comparison, a hotel such as the New York Hilton, one of the biggest in Manhattan, and one I'd always assumed was a huge success, accounted for less than 1% of overall Hilton profits. It was a sobering thought. For nearly 2 years, I'd been working day and night to try to build my own huge hotel on 42nd Street. I wasn't getting my approvals. I wasn't getting my financing. And it seemed highly likely that the whole deal was going to fall through. Now, for the first time, it occurred to me that even if I finally got the hotel built and it became a major success in the greatest city in the world, it still wouldn't be nearly as profitable as a moderately successful casino hotel in a small desert town in the Southwest. By this point, I had invested a great deal of time in the Commodore deal, and I tend not to give up on something I've started. But what I did, shortly after I heard that radio report, was take a trip down to Atlantic City. A year earlier, a referendum to legalize gambling throughout the state of New Jersey had been badly defeated. Now a new initiative was on the 1976 ballot to legalize gambling solely in Atlantic City. It certainly seemed worth checking out. I've never had any great moral problems with gambling because most of the objections seem hypocritical to me. The New York Stock Exchange happens to be the biggest casino in the world. The only thing that makes it different from the average casino is that the players dress in blue pinstripe suits and carry leather briefcases. If you allow people to gamble in the stock market, where more money is made and lost than in all the casinos of the world put together, I see nothing terribly different about permitting people to bet on blackjack or craps or roulette. To me, the key questions about legalizing gambling in Atlantic City were economic. Was the timing right? Was the price of entry reasonable? And did the area make sense as a location? Atlantic City is 120 miles from New York City, on the south shore of New Jersey. And once upon a time it was a great resort and convention center. But when the convention business shifted to bigger cities and warmer climates, Atlantic City fell on hard times. I wasn't prepared for how badly things had deteriorated. It seemed almost like a ghost town, with burned-out buildings, boarded-up stores, and the feeling of despair you sense immediately in places where a lot of people are out of work. Ironically, the prospect of legalized gambling had already sent Atlantic City land values soaring, particularly along the boardwalk by the ocean. Speculators, everyone from large public companies to fly-by-night con men, had moved in like vultures. Families living in tiny homes that they couldn't have sold a year earlier for $5,000 suddenly found themselves being offered $300,000, $500,000, and even $1 million. It was a little ridiculous, and I decided not to be one of the speculators. I didn't like the idea of putting up a lot of pure risk money. Say, for example, I paid $500,000 to buy a piece of property before the referendum. If it failed, my $500,000 investment would drop in value to almost nothing the next day. If the referendum passed, that same piece of land might cost me $2 million. But I thought it was a better bet to pay more for a sure thing. The economics of a successful casino operation are so strong that paying a little more for a good site would eventually prove to be a small expense. Sure enough, the referendum passed in November 1976 and was signed into law by the middle of 1977. By then, however, the Grand Hyatt project was finally moving forward, and the price of land in Atlantic City had become more astronomical than I had anticipated. Just as I'd done 5 years earlier in Manhattan when prices seemed too high, I decided to stay on the sidelines a little longer. I knew that if I was patient and kept my eyes open, a better opportunity would eventually arise. Nearly 3 years passed, but finally, in the winter of 1980, I got a call from an architect I had looking out for me in Atlantic City. He told me that a certain prime piece of boardwalk property I'd always been interested in might be available. The timing couldn't have been better. For one thing, the first wave of euphoria about the casino business had passed, and times were tougher. A few casinos, resorts, Golden Nugget, Caesars, were doing terrific business, but the more recent ventures had run into all kinds of problems. Bally, the newest casino in town, had come in at least $200 million over budget. The Tropicana facility, owned by Ramada Inn, was experiencing severe construction delays and enormous overruns. Bob Guccione, of Penthouse, had announced plans to build a boardwalk casino, only to find after acquiring a site that he couldn't get financing. Hugh Hefner's plans for a Playboy Hotel casino fell apart after he was turned down for a license by the Casino Control Commission. A half dozen lesser-known players had come riding into town with great plans, only to be derailed by trouble with financing and licensing, or intimidated by the huge cost of building a hotel casino. Atlantic City's reputation had also been hurt by corruption charges growing out of the FBI's Abscam sting operation. In 1980, the vice chairman of the Casino Control Commission, Kenneth MacDonald, resigned after admitting that he'd been in the room when a $100,000 bribe was passed to a local politician by potential investors looking for help in getting a casino license. To make matters still worse, the winter of 1980 had been particularly harsh, freezing cold and so windy that in January and February you could barely stand up on the boardwalk. Suddenly, a city that had been very hot for several years turned very cold, literally and figuratively. No one was talking about building any more new casinos. It seemed possible that the gaming business in Atlantic City was going to prove to be seasonal at best, enough to sustain only a few casinos. In my view, however, that translated into an opportunity. The worst of times often create the best opportunities to make good deals. The 2.5-acre piece of property that I got the call about was at the center of the boardwalk, just off the main road leading into town from the Atlantic City Expressway. In addition, the site was directly alongside the convention center, the largest space available for conventions and major entertainment, and a potential funnel into any casino built next door. I was convinced that there was no better casino site in town. Perhaps not coincidentally, it had already proved to be one of the most difficult to assemble. By 1980, everyone and his uncle had tried, and the result was a legal mess. Fragmented ownership, overlapping agreements, disputes over options, liens on individual parcels, and warring factions. The status of the site seemed almost impossible to comprehend, much less to untangle. Every lawyer and real estate broker I spoke with told me flat out that if I really wanted to build a casino in Atlantic City, I'd be far better off purchasing a site that was already assembled. I listened to the advice, but I wasn't convinced. First of all, I always believe in going after the best location, if you can get it at a reasonable price. Secondly, I have an almost perverse attraction to complicated deals, partly because they tend to be more interesting, but also because it is more likely you can get a good price on a difficult deal. Had I tried to assemble the same site back in 1976, the story probably would have been very different. At that point, I had yet to build anything in New York, and no one really knew who I was. But by 1980, with the Hyatt under construction and the Trump Tower project announced, I had a much higher profile and a lot more credibility. When you're negotiating with people who've been promised the world a half dozen times and gotten nothing, credibility is critical. The site consisted of three large parcels, each one owned by a different investment group, as well as a half dozen small homes owned by individual immigrant families. The key to putting the deal together was making every parcel in the deal contingent on my getting all of the others. The only chance of building the great facility I envisioned was to put together the whole site. The last thing I wanted to do was invest a lot of money and then find myself squeezed at the end by one holdout owner who understood the value of controlling the final piece in a puzzle. That's what happened to Bob Guccione on the site next door. To this day, underneath the rusting frame of an unfinished building, there remains a single-family home that Guccione never managed to purchase. Even if he'd gotten financing, he would have had a problem. Imagine spending $300 million or $400 million on a gleaming, glamorous new facility, but building it around a rotting five-room shack. Instead, I set out to leverage my credibility. I told the owners of the sites that I was prepared to make a fair deal, and that unlike all the others before me, I was going to follow through. I pointed out that I had a strong track record when it came to developing property. I also suggested that I might be the only person around who still had the inclination to put this deal together at all. If they couldn't come to an agreement with me, I said, they might be sitting on their property for many years to come. The major part of the deal was for the three large parcels on the site. The groups that owned them were known as SSG, Magnum, and Network 3, and I negotiated with the principals of each group myself. Rather than trying to purchase the pieces outright, I sought very long leases with options to purchase at a later date. My strategy was to keep my upfront investment down, and also to avoid seeking major financing at a time when banks were wary about Atlantic City. In the case of leases, I could carry the costs myself. My pitch was very simple. I was prepared to buy them out, quickly and cleanly. They, in turn, had to cooperate with me and with each other, so that all closings could be simultaneous. They also had to drop the lawsuits they were waging against each other over prior attempts to jointly sell or lease the land. I did not want to get involved down the road in a legal morass. The properties I bought outright were the individual homes. I hired local people to negotiate on my behalf, because many of those we were negotiating with were immigrants who spoke very limited English and weren't used to dealing with outsiders. Other developers had paid up to $1 million for tiny plots and strategic locations. Because times had turned bad, I was able to purchase nearly all of the houses at much more modest prices. By July 1980, we had all the pieces in place. I remember closing day very well. We had arranged simultaneous closings, beginning on a Friday afternoon in the offices of one of our attorneys in Atlantic City. The closings went on around the clock. It took 28 hours before everything was signed and sealed. At that point, we had a room full of people almost delirious from exhaustion, but I controlled the best site in Atlantic City. Before I could move forward, I still had to get financing, architectural approvals, and licensing as a casino operator. More important, I had to decide whether the timing was right to undertake this huge project. Fortunately, I didn't feel pressed to make any quick decisions. It was true that I had several million dollars invested, including lawyers' fees, preliminary architectural drawings, staff costs, and purchase and lease of land, but I was very confident that if I wanted to turn around and sell my assembled site to someone else, I'd get a great deal more for it than I'd put in. There are always buyers for the best. In the meantime, my first priority was to get licensed by the Casino Control Commission. I'd followed Atlantic City closely enough to know that the licensing process could be very long, very difficult, and very unpredictable. Playboy and Hugh Hefner, for example, were turned down for a license because the company had allegedly paid a bribe 20 years earlier in order to get a liquor license for the Playboy Club in Manhattan. When Hefner testified in New Jersey, he took the position that he'd actually been shaken down for a payment, and that neither he nor Playboy had ever been charged with a crime. Even so, his license was denied. The state official who cross-examined Hefner said afterward that several commissioners hadn't liked Hefner's demeanor and style on the witness stand. I don't believe he helped his cause when he walked into the hearing in Trenton, New Jersey, with blazing pipe, silk suit and shirt, and a blonde bombshell at his side. The licensing process is very subjective. If his savvy daughter, Christy, had been involved at the time, perhaps the outcome would have been different. Much more serious allegations of connections with organized crime had been raised against several other applicants. Caesars and Bali were among them. But nonetheless, they both eventually got licensed. What became clear to me, as I watched the licensing process, was a pattern of something I call bloodletting. In exchange for a license, applicants were regularly being forced to offer up at least one sacrificial lamb. At Caesar's World, it was the Perlman brothers who had to resign from the company, and at Bali, it was William O'Donnell. But unlike a large public company, I couldn't afford to sacrifice anyone. I had to demonstrate an absolutely unblemished background. The first thing I did was hire a lawyer to represent me. Nick Ribas was originally recommended by the Newhouse family, for whom he'd done a lot of work. I have great respect for the Newhouses, and when I met Nick, I liked his style. He was probably 30 at the time, but he looked years younger. The first thing I said to Nick was, "Look, I'm just not sure a lawyer as young as you are can handle a big project like this." Nick wasn't thrown. "To tell you the truth, Mr. Trump," he said, "I've never had a client as young as you who could afford my bill." Nick and I agreed immediately on a strategy. I'd hold back on any construction until we got a decision on licensing. In every previous situation, companies who purchased or assembled sites in Atlantic City had begun the licensing process and construction concurrently. Licensing could take as long as construction, and the sooner the casino got built, the faster it could start earning money. It's perfectly logical, so long as your licensing comes through in the end. But unlike these other companies, I didn't want to put several $100 million at risk in the meantime. Also, I didn't want to be in a weak negotiating position with the Casino Control Commission. Once you've begun investing huge sums of money, it's very hard to say no to anything they ask for. Waiting to get a decision on licensing meant paying carrying costs on my land a little longer and postponing profits, but it seemed more than worth it. To this day, not many people or companies are willing to go through the nightmare of licensing in New Jersey, which gives Nevada a big advantage in attracting new investors. My strongest card was the fact that construction of new casinos in Atlantic City had come to a complete standstill. State and city officials, I knew, were hungry for new evidence that Atlantic City was still a good investment. Because my credibility as a major builder had been established, I was confident that state and local officials would be receptive to my constructing a major casino hotel in Atlantic City. I didn't want to be in the position of pleading with anyone. At the very least, I wanted to deal as one among equals, all with an interest in making the project work. By this time, I brought my brother Robert aboard to work with me on the project. Unlike me, Robert decided after graduating from college to work on Wall Street, perhaps as a way of getting out from under the family shadow. He started in corporate finance at Kidder Peabody. 3 years later, he moved to Eastdale Realty, and for the next 5 years did corporate real estate finance work. Finally, he moved to Shearson Loeb Rhodes, where he set up a real estate finance group and ran it very successfully until he joined me. I think both of us always assumed that eventually he'd come back to the family business. Atlantic City was the perfect opportunity. I was looking at a potential investment of $200 million in a town 120 miles from New York City, where I couldn't possibly be hands-on every day. What I needed was someone totally competent, totally honest, and totally loyal to oversee the project. There's nothing to compare with family if they happen to be competent, because you can trust family in a way you can never trust anyone else. I called Robert one evening in May 1980. We talked for several hours in my apartment, and by the next day, he'd agreed to take over day-to-day responsibility for Atlantic City. Among other things, that meant we'd both go for licensing. On a February morning in 1981, Robert, Nick Ribas, and I drove to New Jersey for a meeting with the Attorney General of New Jersey and the head of gaming enforcement. I was very respectful, but I was also very blunt. I said that I was prepared to make a major investment in New Jersey, my own money, not corporate money, and that I'd already invested several $1 million on my boardwalk site. What concerned me, I said, was that New Jersey had acquired a reputation for making it very difficult for any developer to do business in the gaming area. Licensing investigations had dragged on for 18 months and more. Much as I wanted to build a great casino on the great site I'd assembled, I said, I had a very successful real estate business in New York, and I was more than willing to walk away from Atlantic City if the regulatory process proved to be too difficult or too time-consuming. The bottom line, I concluded, was that I didn't intend to invest any more money or to begin any construction until I got a decision one way or the other on my licensing. The Attorney General said to me, "No, Mr. Trump, you're not right about New Jersey. The licensing process can work here efficiently. I can't give you any promises about the outcome of your investigation. We may find out that you're not licensable. What I can promise is that if you cooperate fully, we'll give you an answer one way or the other in 6 months." Then he turned to his director of gaming enforcement and said, "Isn't that true?" The director tried to walk a tightrope. "Well, we'll do our best," he said, "but it may take a year." At that point, I jumped back in. "Well, if it takes a year," I said, "then I'm out of here. I'm prepared to cooperate fully, but I'm not going to sit around twiddling my thumbs waiting for answers." The Attorney General nodded, and his director agreed. It was clear that 6 months was our timetable, and they would try very hard to meet it. The next thing we did was to sit down with the members of the Casino Control Commission staff. In order to build a casino, you need approval on everything from room size to casino layout, from the number of restaurants to the size of the health club. Our intention was to provide the regulators with detailed building plans and architectural drawings well in advance of our construction, so that before we got started building, they'd have a chance to review our plans and tell us what changes they wanted. Other operators, experienced in running casinos but not in building them, hadn't bothered with this sort of planning. In a rush to get their facilities up and open, many began construction before they got final approvals, only to have the regulator show up and say, "No, this room is too small," or, "No, this slot machine needs to be there instead of here." From long experience, I know that mid-construction changes are extremely costly, and perhaps the key reason so many major projects suffer huge cost overruns. With so many regulators and regulations to satisfy, we had one major advantage: the fact that we are not a bureaucracy. In most large public corporations, getting an answer to a question requires going through 7 layers of executives, most of whom are superfluous in the first place. In our organization, anyone with a question could bring it directly to me and get an answer immediately. That's precisely why I've been able to act so much faster than my competitors on so many deals. Sure enough, the gaming division concluded its investigation and issued its report on October 16, 1981. Nearly 6 months from the day they began. They had lived up to their word. Better yet, both Robert and I got an absolutely clean bill. The Division of Gaming Enforcement recommended licensing both of us. My actual licensing hearings weren't scheduled for several months after the Enforcement Division report was complete. In the meantime, we managed to get all the necessary approvals for our construction. Among them was permission from the city to build a skyway connection between our facility and the convention center next door. One consequence was that we could build part of our facility over the road and thus end up with one of the biggest hotels in town on one of the smaller sites. Unlike the owners of many of the boardwalk hotels, we oriented our rooms and restaurants to the ocean. With such beautiful views available, why not take maximum advantage of them? The second issue we worked on was financing, which was hardly a given. Most banks had an unwritten policy against making loans in the gaming business, because gaming had an unsavory reputation. My problem, ironically, was almost the opposite. Our reputation among banks was very good, but when it came to the gaming business, we had no track record at all. My solution was to try using that to our advantage. Better to lend to a reputable company with a clean slate, I'd say, than to an experienced gaming operator with a questionable reputation. Also, I said, because we were proven developers and builders, we were in a far better position than most casino companies were to assure any lender that we'd come in on time and on budget. Manufacturers Hanover, which had helped finance the Grand Hyatt, was among the banks that had a vague policy against making loans in the gaming business. Nonetheless, they agreed to provide me with funding because of our successful relationship in building the Hyatt. I wasn't thrilled about the terms they were offering us, but it was hard for me to complain. I was lucky to get financing at all. On March 15, 1982, with provisional financing in place and all my architectural and building plans approved, I went to Trenton, New Jersey for licensing hearings before the Casino Control Commission. Hearings for other companies had sometimes dragged on for 6 to 8 weeks. Shortly after 10:15 a.m., I took the stand. I testified for 17 minutes. Just before noon, the commissioners voted unanimously to license both Robert and me, as well as our corporate entity, the Trump Plaza Corporation. I was finally on my way. Then something totally serendipitous happened. One morning in June, I got a call in my office from a man named Michael Rose. I was impressed. I had never met the man, but I knew that he was the chairman of Holiday Inns. I picked up the phone, and Rose introduced himself. He was very pleasant, and he said he'd like to come up from Memphis to see me. I didn't even ask the reason. A guy in Rose's position doesn't suggest a meeting unless he's got something worth talking about. Also, I was fairly sure I knew his agenda. I assumed he was interested in buying a property I'd purchased a couple of years earlier, the Barbizon Plaza Hotel on Central Park South and Avenue of the Americas. I knew Holiday Inns had been looking for a prestigious location in New York City, and I'd let the word out in the real estate community that I might consider selling the Barbizon for the right price. A week later, Mike Rose came to see me. Robert and Harvey Freeman joined us. Rose was an impressive-looking guy, tall, well-dressed, and very much the gentleman. I launched right into a pitch about what a great piece of property the Barbizon was, an incredible location, a piece of the rock, nothing like it. How smart he was to come and see me about it. While I really didn't want to sell it, I said, perhaps I could be convinced in this case. For 10 minutes, I just ranted and raved while Mike Rose, the chairman of Holiday Inns, sat and listened very politely without saying anything. Finally, looking a little embarrassed, he said to me, I don't think you understand, Donald. I'm not interested in the Barbizon Plaza. I'm interested in being your partner in Atlantic City. That's what I'm here to talk about. I like to pride myself on rolling with the punches. I had never thought of a partner in Atlantic City. But I jumped right back in and started talking with the same enthusiasm about our plans there. I said that we had the best site on the boardwalk, that we designed the best facility, that we had our approvals and financing in place, and that we planned to be open for business in less than 2 years. Two things intrigued me immediately about Holiday Inns. First, the company had a lot of gaming experience. Second, they had the ability to finance the deal themselves, which could take me off the hook personally. What wasn't clear to me was why Rose might be interested in a partnership. Holiday already owned one successful casino in Atlantic City, Harrah's at the Marina. I knew they were interested in a boardwalk casino, but they had already bought a very costly boardwalk site, and I just assumed that's where they'd build. Nonetheless, I decided to play a little coy. After all, he'd come to see me. "Listen, Mike," I said, "I have my financing, I have my license, and I have my approvals. Frankly, I don't need a partner. But what is it exactly that you have in mind?" Rose explained that he was interested in my site by virtue of its location, but more important, because of my reputation as a builder who came in on time and on budget. Like most other casino operators, Holiday had experienced endless problems in construction and had run over budget by tens of millions of dollars on Harrah's Marina. Rose particularly liked the idea, he said, that we were already under construction. The point, Rose concluded, was that Holiday simply couldn't justify major overruns to stockholders a second time. Making a deal with us, he said, seemed like a good way to marry their management expertise with our ability as builders. Rose had a specific deal in mind. We'd build the hotel, they'd manage it, and we'd split the profits 50-50. In addition, he said, they'd put up $50 million of their own money toward construction and reimburse me immediately for approximately $22 million of my expenses up to that point. We also agreed they'd take over responsibility for financing and use the Holiday Inn's guarantee to get us a very prime rate. As a final inducement to make the deal, Rose said that Holiday would guarantee me against any operating losses for a period of 5 years from the date the casino opened and pay me a large construction fee. This was almost too good to believe. Several times, I looked over at Robert and Harvey just to see if perhaps I was missing something. They just smiled. By the time Mike Rose left my office, we had shaken hands on the basic elements of a partnership in Atlantic City. It was still subject to the drawing of documents and to approval from his board of directors. I assumed that they'd exact some concessions along the way, but as long as the basic concept remained intact, no downside for me and a 50% share of the upside. It was an extraordinary deal. Better yet, I still believed I was about to enter into a partnership with a quality company run by highly competent casino and hotel operators. After all, I thought, what the hell did I know about running a huge casino hotel anyway? Once we'd finished our negotiations, the final step was approval of the deal by Holiday's board of directors. In many situations, board approval of management initiatives is merely a formality. In this case, I worry that Rose might use his board to help him get out of the deal, or at least force changes in it. Rose scheduled his annual board of directors meeting in Atlantic City, so that the board would have an opportunity to see the proposed site and also to assess our progress in construction. It was the latter that worried me, since we had yet to do much work on the site. 1 week before the board meeting, I got an idea. I called in my construction supervisor and told him that I wanted him to round up every bulldozer and dump truck he could possibly find and put them to work on my site immediately. Over the next week, I said, I wanted him to transform my 2 acres of nearly vacant property into the most active construction site in the history of the world. What the bulldozers and dump trucks did wasn't important, I said, so long as they did a lot of it. If they got some actual work accomplished, all the better. But if necessary, he should have the bulldozers dig up dirt from one side of the site and dump it on the other. They should keep doing that, I said, until I gave him other instructions. The supervisor looked a little bewildered. "Mr. Trump," he said, "I have to tell you that I've been in business for a lot of years, and this is the strangest request I've ever gotten. But I'll do my best." 1 week later, I accompanied top Holiday Inn's executives and the entire board of directors out to the boardwalk. It looked as if we were in the midst of building the Grand Coulee Dam. There were so many pieces of machinery on the site that they could barely maneuver around each other. These distinguished corporate leaders looked on, some of them visibly awed. I'll never forget one of them turning to me, shaking his head and saying, "You know, it's great when you're a private guy, and you can just pull out all the stops." A few minutes later, another board member walked over to me. His question was very simple, "How come," he said, "that guy over there is filling up that hole which he just dug?" That was difficult for me to answer. But fortunately, this board member was more curious than he was skeptical. The board walked away from the site absolutely convinced that it was the perfect choice. 3 weeks later, on June 30, 1982, we signed a partnership agreement. Our budget was $220 million, $50 million from Holiday directly, $170 million on a loan they guaranteed. And that included everything: carrying costs, construction, operating expenses, and required cash reserves. We projected completion in May 1984, but I was confident we could finish ahead of schedule, and even under budget, based on how carefully we'd done our planning. One way we stood to save money was from something known as value engineering. Say, for example, that your architect shows you a certain door he wants to use, which has four hinges on it. Before you approve the door, you have your engineer look at it, and perhaps he says, "Look, you only need two hinges to hang that door, or three if you want to do a really good job." So you eliminate one $10 hinge, and you multiply that times 2,000 doors. And the saving on that one tiny item comes to $20,000. Another good example was the installation of the cooling towers for our air conditioning system. Originally, our architects placed them on the roof of the hotel tower. Through value engineering, we determined that we'd save a lot of money by installing them on a lower section of roof, just 7 floors up, because that roof could be poured much sooner. In turn, we'd be able to start all the piping and electrical work for the air conditioning 6 months earlier. The second way we saved money was by producing very complete plans, so that contractors could bid on every aspect of the job. When you have incomplete drawings, a smart contractor will often come in and underbid the job just to get it, knowing he'll be able to more than cover his costs through the change orders that inevitably occur as plans become more complete. The final thing that helped us keep costs down was the state of the construction industry in Atlantic City in the spring of 1982. The only casino still under construction by then was the Tropicana, and thousands of local construction workers were either out of work or about to be. That gave us a lot of leverage with contractors, who had to either cover a certain overhead or go out of business. I wasn't looking to force these guys to make such bad deals that they'd lose money. On the other hand, I was in a position to negotiate very reasonable prices. I got the building finished right on schedule for a May 14th opening. That meant we'd be able to take advantage of the Memorial Day weekend, traditionally the three biggest days of the year for the casino business in Atlantic City. I also came in slightly under the original budget, at $218 million. It represented the first casino hotel in Atlantic City ever built on time and on budget. On May 14th, the casino opened to a public response that exceeded my wildest expectations. It was a major media event attended by thousands of people, including most of New Jersey's principal officials. The governor, Thomas Keene, was the main speaker, and he was extremely generous in praising what we had accomplished. His praise was echoed by Richard Gogline, then president of Harrah's, who told the crowd that for us to have completed such a huge facility on time and on budget was a near miracle in this day and age. The moment we opened the doors, thousands of people poured in. Everyone was hungry to check out the newest game in town. In a matter of minutes, they were lined up 3 and 4 deep at the tables and the slot machines. It is public knowledge, of course, that Holiday Inns and I had many, many disagreements over the management of the facility. But under the agreement I finally made to buy out Holiday's share, I am precluded from saying anything in detail about those conflicts. While my attorneys unanimously believe that I would win any legal battle over my First Amendment rights on this issue, that's just not the way I do business. As far as I'm concerned, a deal is a deal, and I live up to what I've agreed to, even if I don't believe I'm technically obligated by any specific contractual provision. Suffice it to say that my ultimate buyout of Holiday Inn's share of our casino hotel in February 1986 was one of my most savored transactions. One reason that I particularly liked owning the facility myself, rather than with any partner, has to do with the value of depreciation. Depreciation is the percentage of the total value of a building that an owner is permitted to deduct each year from his taxable earnings. The rationale is that money spent to maintain a building, to offset its normal wear and tear, shouldn't be taxable. Put simply, depreciation permits you to pay lower taxes on your earnings. For example, if the cost of our facility in Atlantic City was $400 million, and we were permitted to depreciate at the rate of 4% a year, that would mean we could deduct $16 million from our taxable profits each year. In other words, if we earned a pre-tax profit of $16 million, our earnings, after depreciation, would actually be reported as zero. Most shareholders and Wall Street types only look at the bottom line, which shows a profit reduced by depreciation. As a result, corporate managers don't like depreciation much. It only makes them appear less successful. But I don't have to please Wall Street, and so I appreciate depreciation. For me, the relevant issue isn't what I report on the bottom line. It's what I get to keep. The best part of the deal, however, was the facility I now owned outright. Merely by running it myself, I felt certain I could earn a far bigger profit. In addition, I planned to build new suites and restaurants. Financing, of course, now became my responsibility. The prime rate had been around 14% when I first started looking at property in Atlantic City. By mid-1986, it had dropped to 9%. My problem with bank financing, even at these lower rates, was that I'd still be required to put myself personally on the line for the money. I didn't find that appealing. As a result, I decided to seek public financing for the project, through a bond issue. The downside was that I'd have to pay a higher interest rate to attract buyers. But the upside was that once the issue sold out, I wouldn't be personally liable. In the end, Bear Stearns was able to sell an offering for $250 million, which not only covered the $50 million cash due to Holiday, but also permitted me to pay off the $170 million mortgage on the building and left me the money to build a suitable parking facility. Interest payments on the financing came to just above $30 million a year. That was about $7 million a year more than I'd have paid for bank financing. But to me, it was money well spent. By relieving me of personal financial liability, it assured I'd sleep better at night. During this same period, I hired a new general manager for the facility, which I had renamed Trump Plaza Hotel and Casino. I looked first at my best competitors. At the time, Stephen Hyde was executive vice president and chief operating officer under Steve Wynn at the Golden Nugget. Before that, he'd worked at the Sands and at Caesars, both top casinos. When I asked people in town to name the best casino executives, Hyde was always at the top of the list. As soon as we met, I understood why. He had a lot of gaming experience. He was a very sharp guy and highly competitive. But most of all, he had a sense of how to manage to the bottom line. A lot of managers focus on maximizing revenue, since that's what gets reported publicly most often. The smarter guys understand that while big revenues are great, the real issue is the spread between the revenues and costs, because that's your profit. No sooner had I hired Steve than we turned around and hired away a dozen of the best people who'd worked for him over the years, including Paul Patai, the number one food and beverage man in Atlantic City. I have a very simple rule when it comes to management. Hire the best people from your competitors, pay them more than they were earning, and give them bonuses and incentives based on their performance. That's how you build a first-class operation. In 1985, the first full year of operation under Harrah's management, the facility earned a gross operating profit of approximately $35 million before interest, taxes, and depreciation. For 1986, Harrah's projected a gross operating profit of $38 million. Based on the first 5 months during which they continued to manage the facility, they were running just slightly under projections. We took over on May 16th. For the full year, our gross operating profit was nearly $58 million, or $20 million more than Harris had projected. This was despite the fact that in June we closed down our existing parking lot to begin construction on the new garage. We're estimating that by 1988, our gross operating profit will reach $90 million. By all rights, that should be the end of the story. However, success running the boardwalk facility with my own management made me see a broader opportunity. Specifically, I started to look around at other possible deals to buy companies that owned casinos. Holiday Inns was an obvious target. Even after selling me the boardwalk facility, they still owned three other casinos, one in Atlantic City and two in Nevada, as well as nearly 1,000 hotels around the world. As a result, in mid-August, 2 months after buying them out in Atlantic City, I began purchasing stock in Holiday. By September 9th, I'd purchased nearly 5% of the company, or some 1 million shares. At that point, I had two basic options. One was to hold the stock as an investment. The other was to go for control. I had no doubt the company was undervalued. For one thing, because they owned so much real estate, they were entitled to large write-offs for depreciation. Therefore, they reported net profits far below what they were actually able to retain. On the basis of a stock price of $54 a share in early August 1986, I was in a position to purchase effective control of the company for not much more than $1 billion. In one scenario, for example, I would sell off all of the non-casino hotels, perhaps for as much as $700 million, and retain just the three casino hotels, which by themselves were worth nearly that much. No sooner did word get out that I'd begun accumulating Holiday Inn stock than its price started to rise. I assume arbitrageurs were buying up the stock, figuring that either I'd make a move for control or someone else would. By early October, the price of the stock had reached 72. On Wednesday, November 11th, I heard from Alan Greenberg of Bear Stearns that Holiday was restructuring the company to fend off any potential hostile bid and was going to borrow $2.8 billion in order to pay an immediate $65 a share dividend to the shareholders. The stock jumped to 76. Without hesitation, I told Alan to sell, and he agreed. I still believe I could have overcome any barriers Holiday tried to put in my way, but I just wasn't particularly eager to spend my life in the court with these guys. The alternative, earning a huge profit on my investment without any battle, seemed far more appealing. By the end of the week, I'd sold my entire stake in Holiday Inns, meaning that in just 8 weeks, I earned a profit of many millions of dollars. Looked at another way, I earned back from my Holiday Inn stock much of the money I'd paid them just 3 months earlier to buy their share of my casino in Atlantic City. Obviously, I can't complain. Perhaps no one was better rewarded by Holiday than I was. But in a way, I got something even more valuable than money from the experience. A first-hand view of corporate management in America. Chapter 9. Windfall. The Battle for Hilton. In my wildest fantasy, it never occurred to me that I would someday purchase the huge casino hotel that the Hilton Hotels Corporation began building in Atlantic City in 1984. To the contrary, I watched with some dismay the progress of construction. I hardly relished another tough competitor in town, especially when the Boardwalk Hotel I owned with Harrah's wasn't performing well, even against the existing competition. Worse yet, it was quite obvious that Hilton, after several years of indecision about Atlantic City, was finally going all out with the major facility. To me, Hilton was a hard company to figure. It was founded in 1921 by Conrad Hilton, who built it into one of the great hotel chains in the world. His son, Baron, joined the company in the 1950s, and of course it was only a matter of time before he took over. It had nothing to do with merit. It's called birthright. In 1966, Conrad finally retired, and Barron was named chief executive. It's not easy to make your own mark on a company your father founded.